Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 24th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, audiobooks to help us understand the world. On this episode, I was joined by Dr. Rona Morrison. She's the author of the book, I Don't Talk to Dead Bodies, The Curious Encounters of a Forensic Psychiatrist. Dr. Rona Morrison was for years a leading forensic psychiatric, and in the book, she shines a powerful, emotional, and surprisingly moving spotlight on the fascinating life and the people she's worked with. It goes beyond the sensationalist headlines to show you just what happens in a world where mental illness occasionally makes good people do bad things. The book delves into the minds of real people whose actions may shock and stun you, but whose stories have the power to challenge your assumptions and the stigma that surrounds mental illness. It was great discussing the book with Dr. Morrison. I hope you enjoy the episode. Firstly, and I'd say predictably enough, I'd like to begin by talking to you about the title of your book. How often has that happened where you've told someone your job and the first question they ask is something more related to what one would usually associate with the word forensic in the job title?
It happens a lot. I think when you say the word forensic, people think CSI, scenes of crime, autopsy. And so they miss the psychiatry bit. So they hear forensic, and I think they hear science rather than psychiatry. But you can't talk to dead bodies as a psychiatrist. It's a bit late. So I used to start all my lectures or, you know, introductions to people about my job by saying, I don't talk to dead bodies, and then explaining that forensic's actually to do with crime and the courts, and it was to do with the link between mental illness causing people to offend on a very rare occasion, and my job was to try and find them.
So how much would you say your upbringing contributed towards your career path?
I think it contributed quite a bit, although the final destination wasn't quite where I was headed. So my elder sister was born with learning difficulties, physical disability and sensory impairment. So she couldn't see or hear or talk. And so I was very close to her, despite the fact we couldn't communicate. I don't know if she ever knew me, to be honest, but when I was visiting her in care, she was needed 24-hour care. I used to speak to the other patients when it wasn't my turn to jiggle her on my knee or whatever. I just liked working with people with learning difficulties and thought that would be my career path, become a doctor and then specialise in that area. But my sister, I didn't judge her. I loved her for who she was. And I think that non-judgmental sort of gene, if you like, has been there since an early age, and that allowed me to work with the client group that I eventually ended up working with.
There was a part in one of the earlier chapters where you said something along the lines of how she led a meaningful life because it affected so many people's career paths, or life paths rather.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, a sweet thing to say.
Yeah, well, she did. My dad, although he didn't work in the caring field, he ended up becoming a Samaritan, helping poor souls in crisis. My mum worked for the Department of Health and Social Security, but in the department working with people with learning difficulties. And my sister ended up becoming a teacher and helping people that way. So, yes, we all ended up in a path one way or another. So I called my sister Vivian my stealth bomber. She kind of affected my path.
Absolutely. So listen to the audiobook. I think it's no exaggeration to say that you have lived quite an extraordinary life, but I'd still like to ask you, what inspired your idea to write the book?
Well, initially, I guess it was a legacy piece. I was finishing my career and I thought it was important to capture that, I guess, for the kids initially. And then I thought, you know what, maybe I could use it to have more of an impact. So I've stopped working face-to-face with people with mental health problems, but perhaps I could influence the mental health agenda, you know, the sort of destigmatisation agenda, and particularly with mentally disordered offenders, people with serious mental illness who have acted and offended in a way that was contrary to what they would normally do when they were ill. And I thought if I could perhaps shine a light, take away the sensationalist newspaper headlines and this, you know, the psycho baby killer, that sort of thing, and actually get behind that, because I had the privilege of meeting the people behind the headlines. They were human beings, someone's brother, son, sister, mother, who had become unwell and offended when they were unwell. And see, I got the privilege of meeting the person and trying to rehabilitate them. So I just wanted to shine a light on them, these resilient individuals who have had to deal with that and move on. So hopefully it shapes the knowledge base of people who are reading it. Hopefully entertains him as well.
You know, it's funny you do say that, because I'd say one thing I did appreciate listening to the audiobook was firstly your sense of humour, but also how personal you were with the book, talking about experiences of your own life, and which were probably tough to write about, let alone record as well, because you actually were the voice of the audiobook, which doesn't tend to happen a lot of times when I do listen to audiobook. It's usually like a voice actor. So I wanted to ask, why was it important for you to also open up about grief in the book as well?
Well, I think it's part of the message is about mental illness isn't something that happens to other people. It happens to everyone from every walk of life. And so just to paint a picture of the job I did trying to help and support other people didn't feel right, because I had had my own issues with bereavement along the path and dealing with my sister's issues and also my daughter developing obsessive compulsive disorder. And so I thought it makes it more real and hopefully more relatable, and that was the main reason for doing it. I thought it's got to be an honest account. I think also narrating it myself, it's a memoir, it's my own story, it felt important to tell my own story.
No one can tell your own story better than yourself, isn't it? So
no, well, I hope not.
How was the process of recording it yourself as well, especially the moments which might have been quite difficult for you to revisit?
It was fun, actually. I went down to England and I was in a recording studio for 3 days, and it really was actually quite good fun. But the end of the book is quite emotional, and I knew it would be. So I just said at that point, I said, we'll just do a sentence at a time for this last chapter. And the sound recording engineer was lovely. And he said, that's fine. But he said, if there's any emotion in your voice, it's okay, because it's real. And that's okay. So I think I managed to get through it okay. Hopefully you managed to hear it through the emotion.
Oh, definitely. Near the end, I could hear the emotion coming through at certain points. But as your producer said, it's real. So for me, it was quite refreshing to hear. I want to talk to you about the techniques you've used in the past in order to gain a patient's trust, most specifically when you've dealt with a patient with, let's say, learning difficulties and you've had to take their blood, as you mentioned in the book.
It certainly wasn't textbook. It was improvising. I had a young lady with Down syndrome who had to have her blood taken, and she was frightened of the doctor and needles and things. And we had a bit of a chat about, well, would you like a drink of Coca-Cola? And she sort of looked at me, so I think it's a bit odd. And I said, well, if you drink that, do you think if I put a needle in your arm, we'll get Coca-Cola out? And she sort of looked at me, I don't know. I said, well, we'll try. And she let me. So just for the avoidance of any doubt, there was no Coca-Cola came out of her vein, but we did get the blood sample. And the other one that I did was, you know that doctors all have a stethoscope. I had to be a doctor and deliver babies and all that during my training, and use a stethoscope then, not so much in psychiatry. And again, frightened children, used to say to them, I've got someone to help me today. And they'd say, who's that? And I'd say, Mr. Onion Man. And they'd say, what? And I had taken my stethoscope to bits, the flat round bit that goes against your skin. I'd taken that to bits and drawn a little onion man with tackety boots. And I used to show them Mr. Onion Man and say he was going to help me. And then they could have a shot and they could try. And again, it just makes it a bit more personal, a bit more fun. I still got my stethoscope with Mr. Onion Man on it. It's a bit worn now, but I still got it. So that was fun too. But the illustration on my book cover, it's a little brain with tackety boots and handcuffs, and that's a criminal mind on a little psychiatrist couch, although I never had a psychiatrist couch ever, but I was more likely to be sitting on some sort of grubby couch in someone's house. But it's important to me to do the illustration because I've got my own art business now that I've retired, and it made it much more personal. It's my own graphics rather than having to use a graphic design company through the publisher, so that's quite nice too. But it does tie back to Mr. Onion Man because it's Mr. Criminal Mind, if you like, same sort of idea.
Ah, so it's all making sense to me now. It's all piecing together, you know. One thing I wanted to ask as well was, what would you say is a vital component in forensic care?
I think the point I made earlier about being non-judgmental, I think you can't work with someone who's raped a granny or abducted a child or something like that, regardless of the fact they were mentally ill at the time and perhaps didn't know that they were doing anything wrong at all. You have to suspend judgment at the door. You have to respect the human being behind that and try and get to know them. It's the only way you can help them and ultimately reduce the risk to the public, because that's a huge part of the job, is to assess and manage risk, because we've got to keep the public safe and prevent the person from offending again as well. So I think that's my key thing, is about respect and non-judgment.
Is that something one can do once they become more accustomed to the job? Or would you say that that's something that's down to the type of person you are?
I think it's not for everyone. You can teach people in any walk of life, you can teach people practical skills. You can teach them how to take a history, how to manufacture a car, do, you know, whatever the job is, you can teach people the skills. But there's something fundamental, I think, about our personality and our thought basis and our judgment and that sort of thing. I think you can explain to people why it's important, but I think for some people it's just not the job for them. We have to respect that. I think I say in the book, that's fine. I wasn't very good with anxious ladies. It wasn't that, you know, they're very worthy of care. I just wasn't my thing. You know, someone with schizophrenia and a machete for some reason was that was my bag. I felt I was able to deal with that.
How important would you say was it for you to put across your own style whilst you were working?
I think it was fundamental to me. I'm not someone who's very good at following rules. I don't mean I'm a rule breaker, but I think I feel really quite, I'm definitely not in fact, but I feel quite constrained if I'm not allowed to sort of deal with an individual rather than following a, this is the symptom pattern that gives you that diagnosis that's treated with this particular drug and this dose. I get all of that and why it's really important. However, not everybody fits the mould, and do you just give up because they didn't, you know, they don't fit that criteria, they've got one symptom missing or that medicine didn't work and that's the gold standard, so well, we've tried. That's just not my bag, so I would try and go off-piste a little bit and try and make sure I dealt with the individual and tried to help them. I always saw people like a jigsaw where, you know, there were different facets to our personality, our behaviour, our thoughts, etc. And I tried to take as detailed a history as possible and pull all that together to try and understand the person and their situation. But if there was something that wasn't quite right, be it a behaviour, maybe they had anger management problems, substance misuse, hearing voices, whatever, it was a bit like they were the damaged bits of the jigsaw and they were the bits we had to focus on to try and improve the overall picture. And sometimes you couldn't improve everything, but you could make a difference by small changes. So that was my kind of way of thinking of the world. It wasn't totally textbook, but hopefully made sense and was person-centred.
Not to say that I'd ever be in a position to do the job that you've done. However, there are things that I learned about certain things that you did in terms of when you were having conversations and you'd talk firstly about their upbringing, their past, and lead up to the things that you might want to ask them. Was that in order to gain their trust as well, as opposed to just going straight into whatever the crime they're being accused of?
Oh yes, I think sometimes lawyers, rightly so, they're trying to protect their clients, tell them not to discuss the offence or to admit to nothing, don't admit to anything. And if you start off, because the focus of myself would be to do a psychiatric report for court on a lot of occasions, if I started off with the offence, you might meet a bit of a brick wall because people didn't want to talk to you. So I would always start by saying, I want to find out a bit about you as a person and understand what's happened to you in your life so that what we'll discuss later on will make more sense. Is that okay? And not surprisingly, most people go, that's okay. But then, I mean, I'm being a bit manipulative because it puts them off guard a little bit because we're not talking about the offence. But it means you can actually gather some information that might be helpful in assessing the offence. You know, if you're talking about school days and truancy and what they got up to and did they try drugs and were they in a gang and did they ever have fights and all that, we're not talking about the actual offence, but I might have gathered information that's valuable about drug misuse or about weapon carrying or about anti-authoritarian attitudes, that sort of thing. And these things are all really important. So it was a bit naughty, but it was actually with the best intent, because the more you understand someone, the more you can actually help them and try and reduce the risk for the future. So yes, in the book I do describe kind of how I went about it, how I did it, giving away my own trade secrets. I don't think they're everyone's trade secrets, but they were mine, so I shared them. And yeah, forgive me those patients who were subjected to that, but hopefully I managed to help them in the long run.
I suppose so. Like, you know, relating it back to Mr. Onion, you're kind of peeling back parts of their life, isn't it, to get
with a stethoscope you can, you know, you're listening through the skin and the muscle and things, you're listening for heart sounds and breath sounds and things. I think I say in the book, we went commando, a bit like, you know, you didn't have your stethoscope because you were talking, and so you're trying to get peel back these layers of the onion, I guess, and find out what's going on inside, and finding a way that allows you to get as much information as possible is the best way you can assess and help someone.
you show great gratitude to the teams you've worked with, honing lifelong friendships in the process. How important would you say did the unity you have as a team contribute to the running of the service and to the well-being of the patients?
I think it was essential. I mean, when you work in the community, as we did predominantly, staff were going out into people's houses, and it was a fluctuating situation of risk. Sometimes people were stable, they were taking their medication, they were going to different activities, they were addressing their life, and then sometimes they weren't. Sometimes they were misusing drugs, they stopped taking their medication, they were involved in fights or mixing with the wrong crowd. And our staff, myself sometimes included, were going into these situations. And so it was really important that if anyone in this team felt that the risk level had changed, they needed support, you literally had to drop everything and go. You cancelled a clinic, get someone else to cover and go out to the house with the nurse or with social work or the police or whatever in order to keep everybody safe and do the right thing. So it was really important we trusted each other's judgment. You know, if the nurse said, "I'm worried, I need you to come," then I went. It wasn't, there was no kind of, "Well, tell me about this and do you think that?" And it was, I trusted them. We trained everyone to quite a high standard. And I think that reaped benefits because people had very sensitive, I call it the sort of risk radars, if their antenna were twitching, that was telling them there was something wrong, then we had to act.
Clearly, the running of the service must have been brilliant because you managed to retain like a lot of members of staff for like a long period of time, wasn't it? The turnover wasn't as high as you'd usually expect.
Turnover was really slow. It's really important to get fresh blood, obviously, in any team too, but we had a very core, particularly nursing staff, who were there for years and years and years. And when we had student nurses would come and go training, the nurses would get mentor awards, and then the nurses would come back and apply to work with us. And we had that with some psychologists, with psychiatrists and nurses. So I think there was a good vibe in the team at that point, and people did have a good experience and could see that we were supportive of each other. And I think that's quite important in a team. Nowadays, it's quite difficult. People are quite fractured in teams and so busy that they don't get a chance to meet together and support each other as well.
I wanted to ask you what perspective of others would you think would be challenged whilst reading the book or listening to it? But I do feel as though you've kind of answered it within different parts of other questions that I've asked. So how about I ask you, what would you expect one to feel whilst listening to the book or reading it?
Hopefully not bored of me for 6.5 hours, but apart from that, I think, and you can tell me, you've read it, you've listened to it, I think it's a bit of an emotional roller coaster. It's what I think, be prepared that it's not just someone telling you about their job. As you mentioned earlier, it does touch on bereavement and quite open and honest bereavement towards the end in particular. And I think when you hear people talking about grief, quite often it triggers your own emotions, particularly at the time of COVID when people had really difficult experiences, when they lost people, perhaps couldn't be with them in hospital, couldn't have a funeral, that sort of thing. And so I think even with the Queen passing away, I think a lot of the grief related to her, but I think a lot of it related to people. It was releasing emotions from elsewhere. So I think the book might do that for people, particularly in relation to grief. But I hope that it also offers some hope and that, there is a life after difficult circumstances and that we go on and we have to embrace it. I think most importantly, we get one shot at life. So you need to grab it with both hands. And when something difficult happens, it's all the more important to say, well, you don't know what's around the corner, what's next. I may as well live my life today and make the most of it. And that goes for anyone with a mental health problem. I think hopefully it gives hope that when they're reading it, that actually, I might have an illness and it might be a lifelong illness, it might recur. There are things I can do to control it and manage it, and there are people to support me, but also that you can live a life despite illness, or even if you've committed a serious crime because of illness, it doesn't define you. It's a bad thing that happened, but sometimes, very occasionally, mental illness makes good people do bad things, and it doesn't define them, and we need to get that good person to shine through and to move forward.
Brilliant. Lastly, Rona, how is retirement? And do you still play badminton?
Too fat for badminton, I'm afraid. But no, retirement is very busy. I have started my art business, Rona Morrison Art. So I've gone back to my passion after about a 40-year gap. I do commissions of watercolours and pen and ink pointillism. So I do that. I've written my book, obviously, which has been fun. I'm in Rotary, which is a worldwide organisation who do fundraising for charity and help local communities. I'm president of my club at the moment, so that's been good. And I'm in a business breakfast group, so I have to get up really early. And I've got a team in a local high school who are doing the Young Enterprise Programme, so it's young entrepreneurs, and I'm their business support, so I do that as well. So in amongst all that, I play a little bit of tennis very badly. But life is good, and I think, I say, yeah, enjoy the world. I like to cruise, that's my main thing, is travelling, so I'm going on a trip to Antarctica in February, so that's quite exciting. So keeping busy, I think.
That was Dr. Rona Morrison, author of the book I Don't Talk to Dead Bodies, The Curious Encounters of a Forensic Psychiatrist. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Dr. Morrison for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous episodes if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.